one comforting her. So, that's that. I'll go home. You'll go back to school, and things will return to normal.
I don't like normal, she said.
Neither do I, Bran said. I detest normal. I abhor it, he agreed.
I simply loathe normal, she said,
and Bran gave a weak laugh, and then they got up and made some tea. 23. Jane.
There's a letter for you,
Mrs. Fairfax said at breakfast.
For me, Jane said. Charlotte and Mr. Blackwood had only just left Thornfield, and Jane couldn't imagine anyone else sending her a letter.
Mrs. Fairfax pushed it across the table toward Jane, who opened it with curiosity. It was from Bessie, Jane's nursemaid from Aunt Reed's house.
Dear Miss Eyre, your Aunt Reed is taken ill and is confined to her bed. She has requested to see you. Please make haste, as her time on this earth shan't be long.
Jane frowned.
Is everything all right, Miss Eyre?
Mrs. Fairfax inquired.
No, it is my aunt. She is dying and has requested to see me.
Oh, I am sorry. You shall pack your things at once. Eliza!
A kitchen maid entered.
Please help Miss Eyre pack her things.
But can you spare me for such a trip?
Jane asked.
We can and we will, Mrs. Fairfax said.
I thank you, but I will not need Eliza's help. My belongings are few.
Very well, Mrs. Fairfax said.
Jane lowered her gaze.
I will, however, need some money. I have not yet received my wages.
You must take that up with the master,
Mrs. Fairfax said, returning her attention to the morning's post.
Right,
Jane muttered, not looking forward to such an uncomfortable conversation. She returned to her bedchamber to pack her meagre belongings. Helen was not quiet with her feelings about the trip.
Your Aunt Reed doesn't deserve to spit in the same room as you.
She's probably rather dehydrated and will not be spitting at all, Jane said.
Nevertheless, I'm glad you are leaving Thornfield Hall and Mr. Rochester. He is not a good man.
Jane frowned.
You don't know that.
He's deceitful.
We can't be sure.
Fortune teller, bloody man, screams from behind the door.
Helen ticked these off on her fingers. Okay, maybe he has, on occasion, not been fully forthcoming with the truth. Jane had to admit the ghost had a point. When she went to approach Mr. Rochester about her wages, she found him in the drawing room, speaking in hushed tones, with Blanche Ingram. Jane felt a pang in her chest.
Does that servant want you?
Miss Ingram said. Mr. Rochester glanced up, and when he saw it was Jane, he excused himself immediately, leaving Miss Ingram frowning behind him.
What is it, Jane?
I have to leave.
What? He didn't bother hiding the disappointment in his voice. Do not tell me that whole business with the Ashtons has changed your mind about staying here.
No, I have a sick aunt. She has asked to see me.
Jane pulled the letter out of her pocket and handed it to him. He took it and glanced it over and handed it back.
This is the aunt that cast you off and sent you to Lowood?
Yes, I will not deny a dying woman her request. I should only be gone a week or so.
A whole week or so?
He sighed and let his head drop.
If you must, you must.
One more thing, Jane said, feeling incredibly awkward. I have no money. You haven't paid me.
I haven't paid you? But isn't that one of the things my staff says about me, that I pay in a timely fashion?
He smiled and her heart went boom.
How much do I owe you?
She lowered her voice.
£15?
He pulled out his wallet and dug through its contents.
Here's 50.
I can't take 50.
He rolled his eyes and then looked through his wallet.
Then I only have 10.
That will do, sir, but you still owe me 5, Jane said with a smile.
Then promise me, Jane, you will not spend one more minute than you have to with your awful aunt.
He took her hand and Jane saw Blanche Ingram look away.
Promise me you'll come back for your £5.
I promise, Jane said in a breathless whisper.
He didn't have 5 more pounds,
Helen said incredulously. They were in the carriage making the trip to Aunt Reed's, and Helen could not get over the fact that he hadn't paid her all of her wages.
I'm sure he does, just not on him at the time.
You know what's better than 5 more pounds? 5,000 more pounds?
The carriage bumped and jostled along the road, and in the few hours it took to get to Aunt Reed's, Helen wondered about Mr. Rochester's shortchanging of her wages no fewer than 7 times.
At her aunt's house, Bessie met Jane at the door.
"I'm so glad you have come, Miss Eyre. My, how you have grown into an elegant lady. Not quite a beauty, but never mind that. You have come just in time. She's already died once, just before she sent for you. I fear the next time her death will be permanent." She ushered Jane immediately to the bedchamber, where her aunt's frail figure barely formed a lump in the mattress. A tall, translucent man stood beside her, watching her. It was the ghost of Jane's uncle. Helen ducked behind Jane.
"Who's that?"
came a gravelly voice from the bed.
"It's Jane Eyre," Jane said. "You sent for me, Aunt Reed."
"Jane Eyre! I hated that willful, ungrateful child."
Helen snorted indignantly and stepped forward. The ghost of Uncle Reed shook his head and spoke to the lump under the sheets.
"That is not what we discussed, my dear."
Aunt Reed turned away from him. Oh, Jane realized, she can see him now. Her short bout with death had turned her into a seer. This should be interesting.
"Aunt, I am Jane Eyre. You sent for me."
Aunt Reed eyed her up and down.
"You are Jane Eyre, and I can see you brought one of your heathen friends."
Helen looked right and left.
"Is she talking about me?"
She rolled up the ghostly sleeve of her ghostly dress.
"Are you talking about me?"
"Quiet, dear," Jane said. "Aunt Reed, how can I be of service?" She coughed and wheezed.
"I am supposed to confess and make amends before I die."
"What do you wish to confess?" Aunt Reed stubbornly pressed her lips together, and Uncle Reed poked her under her ribs. She flinched.
"I promised your uncle I would take care of you and love you. I didn't."
"I know. I already knew that, Aunt."
"And?"
Uncle Reed prompted.
"And?"
She said the next bit as if it were one word. One four-letter word.
"I believe you about seeing ghosts."
She winced, as if it were physically painful to admit such a thing. "Thank you, Aunt." Jane made a move to leave, but her ghost uncle cleared his throat.
"Oh, one more thing,"
her aunt said. She gestured to her desk, on top of which was a letter.
3 years ago, I received a message from an uncle you never knew existed. He had asked for your whereabouts. He wanted you to live with him, wanted you to inherit his fortune. I wrote back to him and told him you were dead."
"What?" Jane said.
"I am the reason you did not inherit his £20,000.
"What?"
Helen said. But Jane wasn't preoccupied with the money part.
"I have another uncle," she said. "I have family, and you kept him from me."
"Yes, I couldn't stand seeing you happy."
Uncle Reed bowed his head.
"I am sorry for you, Jane."
For a moment, Jane was angry, and really, given the revelation, she should have stayed angry. Family. It was the only thing she'd ever longed for, and now, to learn she could have had it.
£20,000,
Helen said.
"You could have had £20,000.
She took a few steps toward the bed.
"No, we will never forgive you."
"Helen, please," Jane said, because the truth was, she felt sorry for her aunt. To harbour such hatred, to house it inside her heart and protect it with such passion that it ate her alive. "I forgive you," Jane said.
"What?"
Helen exclaimed. "If I didn't forgive her, I would end up as wasted away as she is now," Jane said to Helen. Uncle Reed let out a sigh of relief. Then he looked at Jane's face as if seeing her for the first time.
"Jane Eyre, you are a sight to behold, to have gone from such a plain child."
"I love you, Uncle," Jane said. "I hope you can move on now that this is done."
Uncle Reed nodded.
"Take care, dear niece."
She wet a cloth in the basin next to Aunt Reed's bed and then placed it on her forehead. "Sleep well, Aunt, and know that I hold no ill will for you." Jane and Helen walked out, leaving her uncle to take leave of his wife on his own. When they returned to Thornfield, the remaining guests had all left. Jane thought perhaps Mr. Rochester would be gone as well, but Mrs. Fairfax said he was in residence.
"But I don't expect him to be here for long," she said over tea. "I believe there to be a proposal very soon. Ingram Park is a day's ride, and I am sure the master will be taking great pains to make the trip very soon and very often."
Jane frowned.
"What's the matter, dear? You've hardly touched your biscuit."
That evening, Mr. Rochester found Jane in the library.
"Miss Eyre,
It's about time you came back to us. What kept you?
I've been gone 3 days, Jane said. She literally could not have returned any sooner.
It's too long. Come, let's go for a walk. It's a lovely evening.
They went to the garden, and Jane decided once and for all she could no longer take the not knowing. She could handle anything. Aunt Reed, her lost uncle. She could even handle Mr. Rochester getting married, but she could no longer handle the not knowing. Helen pointed her finger at Rochester.
Are you going to marry Miss Ingram, yes or no?
Jane signalled Helen to be quiet, but the ghost had a point.
Sir, Jane began, I am wondering about my future at this estate, and I hate to be indelicate, but should I advertise for a new governess position?
Mr. Rochester stopped under a tree, the long branches of which blanketed the grass in shade.
Jane, you know I am soon to be married.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a velvet pouch. He opened the drawstrings and took out a pearl necklace.
These are to be a gift for the future Mrs. Rochester. What do you think?
Jane frowned, trying to imagine the necklace on Blanche Ingram.
They will suit her bird neck. I mean, they will suit her very well.
Because everything suited the likes of Blanche Ingram very well.
I guess I will advertise.
Mr. Rochester grunted.
Miss Eyre, listen to me. I believe there is a string below your rib, and it stretches across class and age to me, and it is attached beneath my rib. And if you find another suitable position and leave me, you will pull it out, and I will bleed.
What do you mean? Jane said.
It sounds rather obvious and slightly disgusting, Helen said. He'll bleed.
Mr. Rochester placed his hands on her shoulders.
Jane, I do not wish to marry Miss Ingram.
Jane glanced up.
Excuse me?
I wish to marry you.
Helen gasped.
What?
Mr. Rochester grabbed Jane's hand.
Say yes, Jane. Say you will have me.
No,
Helen said. She made a move to grab Jane's other hand, but of course her hand passed right through Jane's.
Please, Jane, my oldest and dearest friend, please, don't answer right away.
Jane looked frantically from Mr. Rochester to Helen, back to Mr. Rochester and back to Helen. He was everything she'd ever dreamed about, tall, dark, brooding. But he also had a penchant for lying and making Jane think she was crazy and not telling her the full story.
Please, Jane, Helen said. For me, say you need time to think.
He was handsome and charming, and Mrs. Fairfax did say his bursts of anger were often not often. But Mr. Blackwood and Charlotte had doubted his good intentions and questioned his very nature. As much as Jane believed herself to be in love with Mr. Rochester, a little time to think surely couldn't hurt.
Sir, I will consider your proposal.
Rochester looked incredulous.
What?
He squeezed her hand.
Jane, I have never been more earnest about anything in my life. Say you believe me.
Jane tried to wrestle free, but his grip tightened.
Yeah, we know. Shudder.
Please, sir, may I have the night to gather myself and my thoughts?
Rochester sighed deeply through his nostrils. His voice became an angry growl.
Bloody hell, Jane! It would have been so much easier if you just said yes.
He grabbed the strand of pearls, and before she could move away, he threw it over her head and around her neck. Here, dear reader, is where your faithful narrators must step away from Jane's mind, for the pearls were a talisman that held a spirit, and that spirit now inhabited Jane's body, which meant Jane's spirit was squeezed to the side in a most uncomfortable and frustrating for Jane manner.
My dearest, Mr. Rochester said, we shall marry in a fortnight.
Old Jane looked at him, her smile wide.
I cannot wait.
24. Alexander. Alexander had always felt like he belonged in Wellington's office, partly because everyone said Wellington was grooming him to take over one day, which meant Alexander should practice being comfortable in this room, and mostly because he never got in trouble. He was a star agent, after all. At least, he had been. Alexander tried not to slouch as he approached the Duke, who stood at his desk with his hands clasped behind his back and his shoulders set in a thoughtful manner.
What's on your mind, Alexander?
What wasn't on his mind? His chest still ached with the cruel way he'd treated Miss Bronte as they parted. He should have been kinder. Her questions had been fair. Why hadn't Wellington told him everything about Beacons, or that he'd been acquainted with Rochester? There'd been plenty of time.
The note he'd sent telling Alexander not to stay at Thornfield could have mentioned that. He should have been kinder to Miss Bronte, though, and as it wasn't proper for a single man to write letters, let alone visit, to a single young lady, this might very well be the way she remembered him for the rest of her life. Alexander touched the letter in his pocket.
"Sir, it's about Rochester."
Wellington nodded.
"What about him?"
"I believe Edward Rochester is the man who murdered my father." Alexander pulled the letter from his pocket, careful not to rumple the paper even more. Wellington took the letter and read through it twice before folding it and offering it back to Alexander.
"This is your evidence?"
Alexander nodded and tucked the letter away again.
"It proves nothing.
I remember seeing him that night."
"You are 4 years old."
Wellington placed a hand over Alexander's shoulder.
"I believe you, I do, but this won't be enough proof to do anything about it."
Alexander closed his eyes and exhaled. He knew that. He did. But he'd waited so long to learn the killer's identity, and now it seemed he may have waited too long. "The letter makes it appear as though they were friends," he muttered. "And when I was introduced to Rochester in Thornfield Hall, he seemed familiar, as though we'd met before. But he didn't know me." Wellington nodded.
"They were friends. Here, sit down a moment."
He motioned Alexander to the nearest chair, and together they sat.
"You may not know this, though the records are public, but Rochester used to be a member of the society. His wife, too."
"Is that how you know him?" Alexander guessed.
"Yes," Wellington said. "Mrs. Rochester was our beacon at the time, and the best agent the society had ever seen. Mr. Rochester joined us because of her. Although their marriage had been arranged, they seemed to feel real affection for each other."
"What happened to her?"
"The stress of the job became too much for her. Women have such delicate faculties."
That made no sense. Granted, Alexander had little experience with the fairer sex, but Miss Bronte and Miss Eyre were two of the strongest people he knew.
"That hasn't been my experience, sir."
Wellington frowned, only for a moment.
"Well, it was true for Bertha Rochester. She did very well until one day the stress of this job wore her down. To put it bluntly, she went mad, and shortly after died. That's very sad. The loss of Bertha Rochester affected the entire society. As I said, she was a beacon, and her death dealt a great blow to our productivity. We still feel her loss today."
Wellington leaned back in his chair and sighed.
"I'm afraid her death is what drove Mr. Rochester to abandon the society."
"Where does my father fit into this?"
"He was killed."
Wellington's voice caught. He paused, then tried again.
"I've always believed that his death was one of the events that pushed Mrs. Rochester over the edge. They were friends, as you know. He died. She went mad and died. And then Rochester left."
"Why would Rochester kill my father, though? I don't understand."
"Neither do I." Wellington shook his head. "Perhaps."
"Perhaps what?"
"In that letter,"
Wellington motioned toward Alexander's pocket.
"Nicholas wrote about the travesty in the society, and that I, for I'm most certainly the A.W. mentioned, must be stopped."
Alexander sat very still. He'd been curious, of course, but unsure how to bring it up.
"I'm afraid the travesty was that I had sent Mrs. Rochester back to Thornfield to rest. She'd been working so much that the stress was beginning to get to her. I wanted her to have time to recover, then come back. But perhaps I hadn't been clear in my intentions. The three of them, both Rochester's and your father, believed I'd fired her because she was a woman. Your father wanted to confront me, while Mr. Rochester wanted to permanently leave the society. I cannot fathom how that disagreement led to your father's death, though. I'm as shocked as anyone, and now our new beacon is with him."
Alexander's head was reeling with all the information. And really, look how forthcoming Wellington had been. Miss Bronte had worried him for nothing.
"I'll write to Rochester," Wellington said. "We'll get our beacon. Now, take a few moments to collect yourself, and then I need you on this assignment. It's time-sensitive."
"It can't wait. I'd like to pursue more evidence against Rochester." Alexander didn't usually resist Wellington's directives. That time he completely ignored the letter telling him to come home, notwithstanding. But surely the Lord President still understood that this was a special case, one he'd been working on since he was 4 years old. He had leads. He had a suspect. This wasn't the time for random ghost jobs.
Wellington crossed his arms.
This won't take you long. And it is your duty. Your purpose.
Alexander sighed. Wellington was right. Of course he was. It was just so hard to be taken from the revenge business when the revenge that had evaded him for so long finally felt within his grasp.
It's my privilege to obey your commands, sir.
Alexander stood and waited for his orders.
I'm glad you think so.
Wellington opened a drawer in the massive desk and removed a large envelope.
As I said, this won't take you long. All the work is already done, except, of course, capturing the ghost. We have an address, we have a key, we even have the talisman. We only need the seer to see the ghost and capture it.
That did sound rather simple. Most jobs were not nearly so well prepared and left him to do much of the investigation.
I'll send a note to Bramwell and have him meet me at the location. That won't be necessary,
Wellington said quickly. Perhaps too quickly.
You don't need to bother him with this. Bramwell has other things on his mind right now, I'm sure.
Guilt needled at Alexander. He should have tried harder to make his case for Bramwell, but at least the boy hadn't been dismissed. Wellington cleared his throat.
I'll capture the ghost immediately, sir. I expect the talisman return by the end of the day.
Wellington slid the envelope across his desk, which Alexander took.
And, oh, by the way,
Wellington said as Alexander began retreating from the office.
Yes? We'll get Rochester. It will just take time.
Alexander nodded.
Thank you, sir. Now, said Wellington, fetch me that ghost.
Here was a strange thing. The talisman. Oh, true to Wellington's words, the envelope did contain everything that Alexander needed, including a list of grievances against the ghost, which ranged from loosening the cobblestones to trip people walking down the road, to making branches tap against windows they wouldn't normally reach, and generally creating a lot of noise. But the talisman was a strange thing, because it was a ring, and not just any ring, but a heavy gold band with the King of England's crest engraved on top. It was the king's signet ring. That truly begged the question of why. Generally, talismans were objects that had taken a part in murder, like the teacup, or items of importance to the ghost, the pocket watch. So this was unusual, to say the least. Perhaps it was a mistake, or a copy. But no, Alexander had seen signet rings before, and this one had the weight and heft of real gold, and the details on the crest were correct. Though he was no expert, Alexander was reasonably certain this ring was authentic. Though the information in the dossier had given him no insight, perhaps the ghost would be willing to offer answers. Alexander had dealt with more than a few ghosts who wanted to go on and on and on about their lives. Miss Bronte would say perhaps they simply wanted someone to listen, and if he did, they might be more willing to get bopped on the head. This ghost was recently deceased, apparently, and the family could not sell the house until the bothersome spirit was gone, which was where the society came in. Knowing that, and guessing that the ghost would be furious to realize his family was more concerned about selling the house, Alexander might be able to offer himself as a friendly listener and get a few answers, satisfying his curiosity. The house in question was a modest dwelling, not far from the heart of London, on a tree-lined street filled with children playing and flowers blooming. It was quite lovely, if one didn't know there was a rude ghost in residence. Alexander approached the house with caution, taking stock of the exits, the number of people around, and even the angle of the sun relative to the windows, so that if the ghost tried to fight him, he wouldn't risk being blinded by sunlight with the wrong move. He bounced on the balls of his feet, rolled his shoulders, and after a few deep breaths, he marched into the house. The ghost was sitting on the sheet-covered sofa, waiting for him.
Hello.
He was a mousy chap with limp brown hair and a permanent squint, and with trousers that didn't quite reach long enough down his legs, and jacket sleeves that didn't fit down his arms. It wasn't even that he was a large man. Rather, it was simply because he hadn't known how to dress himself well in life, and so he was trapped like this until the end of his afterlife. Though he was the most unassuming ghost to cause such a ruckus, that was hardly the most surprising thing about him. No, the most interesting part of all this was that Alexander knew this ghost.
David Mitten.
The ghost nodded.
How are you, dear boy? You look well, just like your father. You're a ghost.
Mr. Mitten nodded again.
Quite put out about it, as you can imagine.
You seem to be handling it well. Alexander took the ring in his gloved hand.
Surely you've heard the noise complaints, said Mr. Mitten. That's why you're here, right?
Alexander shrugged.
Mr. Mitten, why are you a ghost? Because I died.
When?
2 days ago.
How?
Slipped and hit my head.
Alexander scowled. That seems unlike you, sir. Mr. Mitten shrugged, and behind him some sort of green sludge slid down the wall.
What's that? Alexander asked.
What's what?
That slime behind you.
There's no slime behind me.
Mr. Mitten didn't even turn around.
What's that slime behind you?
Alexander looked over his shoulder. Sure enough, the green goop dripped over the door. It was everywhere now. How unsanitary. All right, so David Mitten was the ghost he was supposed to bring in, and Mr. Mitten was in a chatty mood, but this raised even more questions than before, because Mr. Mitten worked for the Society and the King. He had been, in fact, the liaison and the King's secretary, which explained, maybe, his connection with the signet ring. He'd probably handled the thing more than the King himself. So that meant the King might have given the ring to the Society, but wouldn't he expect it back? How would that work? What with a ghost trapped in it? And why hadn't Wellington said it was only Mr. Mitten? And why was Mr. Mitten behaving so badly, allegedly? And what was the deal with the slime?
Well, said Mr. Mitten, get on with it. I'm ready.
To go in here, Alexander held the ring between his index finger and thumb. Mr. Mitten nodded transparently.
All right.
But Alexander hesitated, because this was all so strange, and he'd really have liked answers. But the clock chimed 6, and he knew Wellington was surely waiting. Plus, the slime was gross.
Well, Alexander said, hold still.
Cautiously, he approached the ghost, half expecting some sort of fight. But Mr. Mitten held perfectly still, while Alexander tapped the signet ring on his head. Immediately, the ghost was sucked in. The gold trembled and glowed, and that was that. David Mitten was trapped in the ring, ready to deliver to Wellington.
Good work, as always.
The Duke placed the signet ring on his desk, then put the handkerchief he'd used while inspecting the ring back into his pocket.
You've done England a great service.
It had hardly seemed like anything at all. Capturing Mr. Mitten had been easy.
You didn't tell me it was Mr. Mitten, sir.
Wellington gasped.
Mr. Mitten? Dead.
He shook his head, a frown tugging at the corners of his mouth.
I wasn't aware of the ghost's identity. If I'd known, I would have told you. Of course, I'm as sorry to hear about David Mitten's demise as anyone. It's a real tragedy what happened to him.
He said he slipped and fell.
It's just awful, isn't it? Life is so brief. It can end in an instant. You never know when your time is up, I suppose.
I suppose,
Alexander frowned. Members of the Society were dropping at an alarming rate.
What about the King?
What do you mean?
We can't give the ring back to the King, not with Mr. Mitten trapped inside it.
You're right, of course. It wouldn't be safe. The King is aware of the issue and he's already commissioned a new ring. It should be ready by Thursday.
How nice that His Majesty could put aside his dislike of the Society to help us with Mr. Mitten,
Alexander said. Maybe the King did sort of believe in ghosts after all. Or more likely, he didn't want to cause a huge public fuss with the Society, figuring it would be on its way out shortly, and this was as good an excuse as any to get a new ring. Alexander would have to ask to know for sure, but he wasn't the type of agent to question his superior. Asking nosy questions was Miss Bronte's job. She wouldn't have hesitated to ask why the King was suddenly so cooperative, or why the signet ring was a talisman, or... Wellington crossed his arms.
What is it?
It's just... You seemed in such a rush to get the ghost.
Wellington folded his hands together.
The family of the deceased,
Mr. Mitten,
wanted to sell the house immediately. They couldn't afford to wait.
But he worked for both the Society and the King. Surely he left them plenty of money. Why not wait until Thursday when the King's new signet ring arrived?
Alexander slipped his hands behind his back and dug his fingernails into his palms.
You're very curious tonight, Alexander.
It was Mr. Mitten, Alexander said. It feels personal. We all cared about him.
Of course we did,
Wellington agreed. Never mind that Alexander, and most people,
regularly forgot that David Mitten existed. He was practically invisible in life, already ghost-like. It seemed like it was only in death that anyone cared about him at all. A true tragedy.
So why not wait? Blast Miss Bronte's influence, her contagious questions.
You've always been a solid agent, Wellington said. The star agent.
Alexander sensed a but.
But that's because of your willingness to do your job without asking too many questions. We who can't see ghosts can only put our minds to work. We rely on you to take action, to investigate and capture, because we cannot. You're so busy with the work you've been dealt. I wish you trusted that we all have thought of every possibility and that we make the best plans we can make. We are the mind, Alexander. You are the sword.
I see. I'm sorry if I caused you any upset, sir.
Wellington waved him toward the door.
Get some rest. You've had an eventful month, and I'm sure you'd like some time alone after the constant company you've kept.
Thank you, sir.
Alexander headed out of the society headquarters and walked toward his flat. Was this what it felt like to be reprimanded? The sensation was so unfamiliar, he wasn't quite sure if it was disappointment in himself or confusion over Wellington's words or something else entirely. But the Duke was right. Maybe it would do him good to finally have some time to himself, some space to stretch his legs without worrying about the others, some freedom to walk around his home with his tie loosened, so to speak. So he went home, alone, and he made tea, alone, and he sat in his parlour, alone. Just days ago, Miss Bronte had perched on that uncomfortable chair, and Bramwell had sulked by the door. He hadn't minded their company. But now he was alone. He liked being alone. Tea for one. His flat was just so quiet. There were no ghosts around tonight, and there wasn't even the sound of a pencil scratching on paper as Miss Bronte recorded everything that happened. Not that there was anything to record here, because nothing was happening.
Hello?
He tested his voice to make sure it still had substance. Not even an echo answered. Yes. He was definitely alone, and, for the first time ever, maybe he was lonely too. No one had ever been so lonely. 25. Charlotte. Charlotte shifted the carpet bag with the broken handle to her other shoulder and sighed. A train pulled into the station, but it was not her train. Her train would not arrive for a good 15 minutes yet. Charlotte generally liked to be early, to allow herself time to locate the places she was supposed to go, given her poor eyesight and her terrible sense of direction. But being early also meant being left with time to think. Normally she didn't mind. Thinking was what Charlotte considered herself best at, after all. This afternoon, however, the thoughts swirling about her brain were dreadfully glum. She was out of options. She had to return to Lowood, where she would probably end up starving to death or succumbing to the graveyard disease, she thought. Or at the very least, she'd be cold and hungry and utterly bored. Conditions at Lowood had been markedly better since Mr. Brocklehurst was murdered, she reminded herself. But the thought didn't cheer her as it should have. Brocklehurst's name only called to mind a bittersweet memory. Mr. Blackwood chasing about the drawing room, waving a teacup in the air. The very first day they'd met, and then the teacup made her think of Bran. Sigh. Bran. For 2 weeks she'd watched her brother stumble about his room, packing his meagre belongings to return to their father and the parsonage. He tried to act cheerful for her sake.
"I find I've been missing home," he'd mused as he'd folded his night clothes into a trunk. "I'll be glad to sleep in my own bed again. This bed never truly felt like mine. So I've been sacked. It could be worse," he murmured as they sat in the middle of the empty floor, drinking lukewarm, sugarless tea.
But Bran didn't elaborate on how it could be worse.
"I know I'm likely to be a terrible parson,"
he'd sighed as he'd climbed onto his northbound train just a few moments ago.
"But I don't need to be the parson right now, do I? Father's the parson, and Father is a paragon of good health. I have years and years before I'm needed in Father's place, so I can just keep up with my studies and maybe to a bit of drawing."
Bran liked to draw, almost as much as Charlotte liked to write. In that way, he was much like Jane. Jane. They had parted so poorly. Charlotte didn't even know what to think about Jane's situation. Jane was in love, and part of Charlotte was keenly envious, and part of her was happy for her friend. To fall in love, even in less than convenient circumstances, must be a marvellous thing. But then, Mr. Rochester was, some might say, a flawed man. That much was clear. And there was also the great possibility that Mr. Rochester was a murderer. What would become of Jane? Charlotte sighed again. The non-broken half of the handle of her carpet bag bit into her flesh. The train that was not hers was about to depart. The conductor leaned out and shouted, "All aboard for Canterbury! Last call for Canterbury!" After a few moments, the train began to chug slowly forward, and then a voice cried,
"Wait! Wait for me! Stop!"
And Charlotte was nearly thrown to the ground as someone bashed into her from behind. That did it for the carpet bag. The other handle snapped at her shoulder, and her clothes and books and bottles of ink and pencils spilled out everywhere. Charlotte said a rather unladylike word under her breath and scrambled to pick up her things. The man who had crashed into her watched helplessly as the train departed without him. Then he turned and stooped to help her.
"That's quite all right," she said a bit snappishly. "I can manage."
"I'm so terribly sorry."
He held up a pair of her pantaloons and then dropped them like they were on fire.
"I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry."
There was something familiar about his voice. She lifted her spectacles and then gasped.
"Mr. Mason!"
He cocked his head to one side and frowned at her.
"Are we acquainted, Miss...
Bronte?"
She filled in, then shook her head wildly.
"You would know me as Miss Eshton, of course, but that wasn't my real name. But that's not important now, because you are Mr. Mason. But how? You were on a ship bound for the West Indies, but you weren't on the ship."
"No," he agreed. "I was..."
"This is wonderful."
She pressed her hands to her face as if to keep her head from exploding.
"We must tell Mr. Blackwood."
"Mr. Blackwood?"
Mr. Mason still looked very confused.
"Mr. Eshton, to you. Don't you remember? Oh, Mr. Blackwood will be so pleased we haven't lost you."
She grasped Mr. Mason firmly by the hand.
"Come, we must go speak to him immediately."
Mr. Mason opened his mouth as if to protest, but she shook her head again.
"You have plenty of time. You just missed your train, and the next train to Canterbury doesn't arrive until 6 o'clock. So you will accompany me to Mr. Blackwood's."
And so it was decided.
"What does Mr. Eshton wish to speak to me regarding?"
Mr. Mason panted after Charlotte dragged him to the nearest carriage for hire, thrust him into it, and then ordered the driver to take them to Baker Street post-haste.
"Mr. Rochester, of course!"
Mr. Mason looked suddenly green, but it could have been the rocking of the carriage. They were proceeding at a rather breakneck speed toward Mr. Blackwood's flat. Charlotte, on the other hand, was smiling. She was going to be useful, after all. When they reached Baker Street, Charlotte took the stairs to Mr. Blackwood's flat two at a time, an impressive feat considering the volume of her skirts. She couldn't wait to see his expression when she presented Mr. Mason, the man with the key to Rochester's mystery. She could feel it in her very bones. It was getting late, nearly supper time. Surely Mr. Blackwood would be home at this hour, she thought as she reached the top of the stairs, and then she barreled through the door without thinking to knock.
"Mr. Blackwood!" she cried. "Alexander!"
At her scream, he came running from a back room.
"Charlotte, I mean, Miss Bronte, are you all right? What's wrong?"
His gaze swept over her from head to foot, searching for injury.
"What's happened?"
"I found..."
She shouldn't have taken the stairs quite so quickly. In a corset. She bent at the waist and focused on breathing for several moments. Then she straightened.
"I found Mr..."
She lifted her spectacles to her face so she could catch his expression when she told him.
"Oh, dear," she said. "You're not dressed."
He was wearing trousers, thank heavens, but she'd obviously interrupted him in the middle of shaving. There were still traces of shaving cream on his face. His hair was wet and gleaming, dripping onto his bare shoulders. His bare shoulders! Because he was not wearing a shirt, which meant that, by pre-Victorian standards anyway, he was more or less completely naked. A blush glowed on his cheeks.
Miss Bronte.
She could feel her own blush heating her face.
"Oh, dear."
She dropped the spectacles.
"I should have knocked."
At that very moment, a knock sounded at the door. Mr. Blackwood swiveled to look at it. Charlotte was glad for the interruption.
"That would be Mr. Mason," she said.
"Mr. Mason?"
Mr. Blackwood looked incredulous. She nodded.
"I came across him at the train station."
"But he was supposed to be on that ship.
headed for the West Indies, Mr. Blackwood said, frowning as if, more than anything else, he couldn't believe he'd been given faulty information.
I know.
But why wasn't he?
Because he...
She stopped.
Actually, I don't know. We should ask him.
She went to open the door. On the other side stood, predictably, Mr. Mason. He immediately looked from Charlotte to Mr. Blackwood in his underclothed state and gave a small, scandalized gasp, because pre-Victorians.
Oh, it's quite all right. I can't see a thing without my glasses,
Charlotte felt compelled to explain. Mr. Blackwood cleared his throat.
Mr. Mason, I am surprised to see you.
And I you, Mr. Mason said.
Mr. Blackwood? I thought you were Mr. Eshton, a magistrate, correct?
Oh, so he remembered Alexander, Charlotte observed a little bitterly. She'd obviously just been furniture dressing to the man.
I'm an agent in the Society for the Relocation of Wayward Spirits, Mr. Blackwood clarified. I was at Thornfield on assignment.
I see, Mr. Mason said, but he clearly did not.
What kind of assignment?
Society business, Mr. Blackwood said tightly.
But while we were at Thornfield, we came to believe that Mr. Rochester was...
Charlotte lifted her spectacles. His brow was furrowed. He was thinking about his poor father. Then she was reminded again that he wasn't dressed, and dropped the spectacles again.
Guilty of certain crimes, he concluded.
Mr. Mason nodded.
I would believe almost anything of Mr. Rochester. After this recent encounter with him, I think him to be nothing short of a nefarious villain.
That's what we think, Charlotte exclaimed. The most nefarious.
But why do you think him so? Mr. Blackwood asked. What harm has he caused you?
Not to me, sir, Mr. Mason said. Outside of the harm of keeping me from someone I dearly love.
Charlotte couldn't help but lift her glasses to her face.
Someone you love?
My sister, Mr. Mason said.
Who's your sister?
Mr. Blackwood demanded to know. He was practically quivering with the excitement of it all, every muscle in his back tense, like he was preparing to confront Mr. Rochester at this very moment.
Mr. Blackwood, Charlotte burst out. Would you please put on a shirt?
Mr. Blackwood's face coloured again.
Mr. Mason, Miss Bronte, please forgive my lack of appropriate dress. Won't you be seated in the parlour until I can rectify the situation?
Of course, Mr. Mason said.
Thank heavens, Charlotte agreed. Mr. Blackwood nodded briskly.
Please, make yourselves comfortable, he directed and hurried out of the room.
Charlotte led Mr. Mason to the two less than comfortable chairs in the corner. They sat. Mr. Mason crossed his legs, then uncrossed them. He glanced around at the walls, but there was no paintings to examine, no decorations. He glanced at Charlotte and then looked away. Then he spotted a newspaper on the small table next to him. Relieved to have found something to occupy himself, he snatched it up and began to read. They waited. Mr. Blackwood did not appear. A clock on the opposing wall ticked oppressively, counting the seconds of his absence. Charlotte shifted uncomfortably. These chairs were truly the most uncomfortable chairs in all of England. We checked. If Mr. Mason was a gentleman, she thought, he should offer her part of the newspaper. Still, it would not be proper to suggest such a thing. She could get up and make them a cup of tea. Tea would be very calming. But to make the tea herself would have to assume some scandalous level of familiarity with Mr. Blackwood's kitchen. As usual, Charlotte found herself hopelessly penned in by etiquette.
Would you like to read?
Mr. Mason offered a section of the paper. She almost sighed in relief. He was a gentleman, after all. But what he handed her was the weddings and obituaries page. It was, to say the least, not the most enthralling reading. She sighed and lifted her spectacles. Mr. and Mrs. Charles Durst, Esquire, are pleased to announce the engagement of their daughter, Miss Cecilia Cecily Durst, to the esteemed Earl of Lancaster, Jonathan Fraser Northrop. The wedding to take place at their country estate on the 15th of September, 1834. Charlotte's nose wrinkled. She amused herself for the next several minutes, rewording the wedding announcements to liven up the stories they told. Mr. Henry Woodhouse is overjoyed to announce the entanglement of his most precious and comely young daughter, Miss Emma Woodhouse, to Mr. George Knightley, the wedding to take place at the nearest available church house immediately. The bride is both beautiful and rich, and enjoyed a brief flirtation with a Mr. Churchill that had everyone quite concerned, but in the end she saw the error of her ways and picked the right chap.
Mr. Edgar Linton of Thrushcross Grange would like to announce his engagement to the lovely Miss Catherine Earnshaw, the wedding to take place on the 21st of September, even though the lady would much rather marry a ruffian named Heathcliff. But she will forego her passion in order to secure social ambition. Charlotte suppressed a giggle. At least she was competent, when the situation called for it, at entertaining herself. She was moving on to the next one when Mr. Blackwood re-emerged, this time fully clothed. He smiled at her with a touch of nervousness. She beamed back at him.
"Can I offer you some tea?" he asked in a voice that portrayed that he was only offering because this was England and it was the polite thing to do, but he'd much prefer to get on with the interrogation.
"I'd love a cup of tea," Mr. Mason replied with an uneasy laugh.
Charlotte sighed and dropped her gaze back to the newspaper, where the next wedding announcement seemed to leap out at her.
"Miss Bronte?" Mr. Blackwood inquired.
"No,"
she gasped.
"No tea?"
"It's not possible."
"Come now, tea is always possible," he said.
"No!"
She jumped to her feet and shoved the paper into his hands.
"Look! Look!"
His eyes scanned down the page.
"What am I supposed to be?"
And then he saw it.
"Mr. Edward Fairfax Rochester of Thornfield Hall is pleased to announce his engagement to Miss Jane Eyre, also of Thornfield Hall, the wedding to occur on the 10th of September." His voice died away. "It's not possible."
"Mr. Rochester?"
Mr. Mason was on his feet now, too. His face had drained of colour.
"Mr. Rochester is getting married."
"Oh, Jane,"
Charlotte breathed.
"Mr. Rochester cannot marry," Mr. Mason said furiously. "He can't."
"Why?" Mr. Blackwood asked. He told them why, and they immediately set out for Thornfield Hall. They were almost too late. Jane and Rochester were nearly to the "Wilt thou have this woman for thy wedded wife?" part of the wedding ceremony when Mr. Blackwood and Charlotte, and Mr. Mason trailing a bit behind, burst into the tiny stone church.
"Stop!"
Mr. Blackwood strode up the centre aisle. Jane and Rochester slowly turned to look at him. Charlotte lifted her glasses. In her elegant silk wedding gown, Jane was as lovely as Charlotte had ever seen her. A simple but pretty veil covered her hair. A stunning pearl necklace gleamed at her throat. Plain girls could clean up well when the situation called for it. Charlotte smiled and waved.
"Nice dress,"
she mouthed. Jane stared back at her blankly. It was almost as if she didn't recognize Charlotte.
"What is the meaning of this?"
asked the priest.
"The marriage cannot go on," Mr. Blackwood said.
"I declare the existence of an impediment."
But Rochester turned away and took Jane's hand again.
"Continue," he directed the priest.
"Yes," murmured Jane. "Continue. We don't know these people."
Well, that hurt.
But the priest obviously wanted to know what the devil was going on.
"It's a man and wife," hissed Rochester. "Man and wife. Man and..."
The priest frowned.
"No,"
he addressed Mr. Blackwood.
"What is this impediment you speak of?"
"Mr. Rochester cannot be married today, as he is already married."
"It doesn't matter," exclaimed Jane passionately. "I love him, and he loves me, and now we'll be together forever." "Wait, you knew about his wife?"
Charlotte gasped. Rochester was shaking his head.
"I don't have a wife. Who says I have a wife? Everybody around here knows that I'm single. Right, darling?"
"Oh," said Jane. "Right. I don't know about any wife except me, very shortly."
"You can't prove anything," said Rochester.
Mr. Blackwood took a piece of paper from his pocket.
"I have a statement here."
He cleared his throat.
"I affirm and can prove that on the 20th of October A.D.,
a date some 20 years back, did we mention that Rochester was really old,
Edward Fairfax Rochester of Thornfield Hall was married to my sister, Bertha Antoinetta Mason, daughter of Jonas Mason, merchant, and Antoinetta, his wife, at St. Mary's Church, Spanish Town, Jamaica. The record of the marriage will be found in the registry of the church. A copy of it is now in my possession. Signed, Richard Mason."
"Okay, so I was married, at one time," admitted Rochester. "But that document doesn't prove that the woman in question is still alive now, does it?"
He turned back to the priest.
"Say man and wife."
"She was alive 3 weeks ago," said Mr. Blackwood.
"How do you know?" asked the priest.
"We have a witness to the fact," Charlotte said, "whose testimony even you, sir, will scarcely controvert."
She turned a gesture to Mr. Mason, who'd been standing at the back of the church this entire time.
Mr. Mason, come forward, please. We need to hear from you now.
Mr. Mason was pale, trembling. He was clearly terrified of Mr. Rochester, with good reason, too, as the want to be groom looked like he was going to rush the poor man at any moment and dispatch him with his bare hands.
Have courage, Mr. Mason,
Charlotte whispered to him.
Tell the truth.
Bertha is my sister, said Mr. Mason in a small voice. I visited Thornfield Hall not even a month ago, and I beheld her there with my own eyes. My sister, Mr. Rochester's wife, is very much alive. She's mad, perhaps, but who wouldn't be mad after all he's done to her? He's had her locked in the attic for 15 years.
Everyone in the church gasped.
I assure you I have a very good explanation for all of this,
Rochester exclaimed. But then he gave a sudden roar and lurched toward Mr. Mason, like his solution to this rather insurmountable impediment to his nuptials was to do away with the witness. Mr. Mason blanched and then promptly slumped to the floor in a dead faint. Mr. Blackwood and the clerk of the church moved to restrain Mr. Rochester. Charlotte rushed to Jane.
Oh, Jane, I'm so sorry to be the bearer of this news. I truly am. But thank goodness we arrived here in time to stop you.
Stop me?
Who are you?
Jane said coldly, grasping Charlotte by the shoulders.
This is your doing, isn't it? I was supposed to be free at last, alive again, with the love I thought I'd lost. But now you've spoiled everything.
Well, it wasn't all my doing, Charlotte deferred,
although I was the one who located Mr. Mason. It's kind of a funny story, actually.
Then Jane's small hands were around Charlotte's throat, and she stopped believing it to be so funny.
Jane!
She gasped out.
If I said something to offend you, I do apologize. But surely you see that it's better not to marry Mr.
She couldn't get the last syllable out. She had no air. Jane was surprisingly strong for a girl of her diminutive size. And everybody in this quite crowded room was looking at Mr. Rochester, who was struggling with Mr. Blackwood, or at Mr. Mason, out cold on the floor.
Jane!
Charlotte croaked. Jane squeezed harder. Dark spots swam before Charlotte's eyes. The world was fading. She gave one last desperate push at her attacker, and her fingers caught the pearl necklace around Jane's slender neck. She pulled, and the necklace broke free. Pearls tumbled down all around them. Jane's hands dropped, and suddenly Charlotte could breathe again. Then Jane's eyes rolled back in her head, and she crumpled unceremoniously to the floor.
26. Jane. There was a fog in front of Jane's eyes, a dense fog that prevented her from seeing anything or hearing anyone. Voices would speak to her, but before the sounds could coalesce into words, the fog would capture them and wrap them up in cottony nothingness, stripping them of all meaning. The head cloud stayed for days and days, and then, all at once, it was gone. And Jane was flat on her back on a hard, cold surface, looking up at several faces. Mr. Blackwood, Charlotte, Rochester, Mr. Mason, and a man in white robes, holding a Bible.
Charlotte, Jane said. Where am I? Oh, dear, Charlotte croaked and then coughed. Do you not remember anything?
No, Jane said. I must have hit my head.
Oh, no. Did I hit my head? Is that it?
Mr. Blackwood crouched by her.
Maybe we should help her up.
Maybe we should tell her what happened before she stands all the way up, Charlotte said.
After further discussion, it was decided that they would help Jane to a chair where she should sit, definitely not stand, to hear what happened. The whole thing made Jane very nervous, but not as nervous as the very next moment when she discovered what she was wearing.
"Why am I all dressed up?"
Jane asked, smoothing her hand down the softest silk she'd ever felt in her life.
"I didn't steal it."
She felt the need to clarify that fact up front. Rochester paced on the other side of the room defensively.
"Somebody, please tell me what happened," Jane insisted. "Well," Charlotte said, "to put it as succinctly as possible, You were possessed by a ghost who then, using your body, agreed to marry Mr. Rochester, who, it turns out, has a secret wife locked away in the attic. And just as you were about to say your vows, we rushed in and stopped the wedding, and I tore off your pearls, which seemed to be the talisman for your ghost. And then you collapsed and, well, here we are.
Yes, aren't we, though?
Rochester grumbled.
Mr. Blackwood clenched his fists.
You, sir, have no right to say anything.
Charlotte went to his side. We should call for the authorities.
And tell them what?
Rochester smirked. Wait, Jane said, rubbing her forehead. Wait. I know, Charlotte said, returning to Jane. Being possessed by a ghost cannot be a pleasant experience. Jane shrugged Charlotte's hand away and stood.
Rochester's married. You're married.
Rochester's gaze darted nervously from face to face.
It's not what you think.
His voice cracked.
Oh, is that right? Because what I think is that you are married and you try to get engaged to a woman who was not your wife and then had her possessed.
Well, I guess in that regard it is what you think, but I can explain.
Jane folded her arms, and then next to her, Charlotte folded her arms, and at that point, Jane noticed someone missing.
Where's Helen? Jane said.
Who's Helen? Rochester said.
Here I am, Helen said, flying into the room. When you were possessed and I realized even I couldn't get through to you, I thought I would go to find help, but I didn't know where to go or what to do without my Jane. I decided the task was going to take a lot of thinking, so I wandered Thornfield Estate thinking until I saw the carriages racing here today for the wedding.
I'm back now, Jane turned to Rochester.
Explain yourself.
Please, come with me.
Rochester held out his hand. Jane didn't take it. He dropped his hand.
I will show you everything.
You shouldn't go with him, Helen said.
I have to know.
Jane and the rest of the wedding party followed Rochester out of the church and down the hill and back to Thornfield Hall. They all entered the manor in a flourish. Housemaids and servants threw rice and flower petals at the couple.
Curse your happy wishes, Rochester growled. There was no wedding today.
The staff scurried away like roaches in a sudden light. Jane and company followed Rochester up the spiral staircase to the top floor of the east wing where Jane had gone so many nights ago when Mr. Mason was injured. When Helen realized where they were going, she turned around.
I'll wait down here, she said. I can't stand being in that room.
Rochester did, indeed, lead them to that very anteroom where Mason had lain, bleeding. Inside, Grace Poole was sitting near the sofa, fabric on her lap, a needle in her hand. She put down her embroidery when everyone walked in.
How is our charge?
Rochester said.
She's a mite touchy, sir,
Grace Poole answered.
Please, show us in,
Rochester said. Grace frowned.
I'm not sure that's a good idea. She's rather snappish of late.
Jane remembered the noises coming from beyond that door the night Mason was injured. The rattling of the knob, the moans that mingled with the wind. A shiver ran through her as she watched Grace open the door. Rochester stepped through the threshold, followed by Jane and the rest of the party. Inside was a large bed, draped with deep red fabric. Red tapestries hung from the ceiling. One such tapestry was sticking out of an open window as if someone were going to attempt an escape, but they were too far up. In the corner, a small table stood. On top of it were two glasses. One lay on its side, liquid pooled around it. Jane couldn't see anyone in the room until a strong breeze forced a gossamer drape aside, and behind it was a woman with ebony black hair sitting in a chair. She was thin to the point of being malnourished. There were scratches and cuts up and down her arms, and her head hung low as if she were asleep. Even so, Jane couldn't stop looking at her. She was luminous, as if a brilliant glow came from deep within her.
"Meet my wife," Rochester said. "I was married to her before I found out hysteria runs in her family."
At his voice, the woman raised her head.
You are not my husband,
she said wearily. Then she noticed Mr. Mason.
Hugh,
she lunged for the man, but wrist restraints jerked her back.
You promised to stay away. Tu as promis.
She repeated herself in French, Jane noted.
Bertha, it is all right. This is your brother. Rochester turned to Mason. You'd better leave. You're upsetting her. In fact, we should all leave.
No, Mrs. Rochester cried. No, this is not my husband. Please.
See, Rochester gestured to her. There is no cure for this kind of madness. She is hysterical. Now, everyone kindly leave so I can tend to my wife.
Mrs. Rochester looked frustrated, exhausted, resigned. But she didn't look crazy.